Be good.
Well, hello there, friends and strangers, pals of mine around the world. It is Andrew, the host of this here fake radio show. It's called the Monkey Tooth Podcast, and I call it a fake radio show because that's ultimately what podcasts are, right? Anyhow, this fake radio show is, it's a good one for me because I've got a wonderful guest. His name is Eric Kaplan. That's Eric with a C, Kaplan with a K. I met him in the Bombay Beach Biennale. What a cool character. He's got so many interesting stories, one hell of a resume. He's written for David Letterman, for Futurama, for Big Bang Theory, for Flight of the Conchords. Just a brilliant comedy writer. Also a writer of books, Does Santa Exist? He wrote a bit about Kierkegaard and the humor in it, which that alone is an amazing feat. The guy is just, he's a very, very thoughtful, deeply philosophical man with insights into, possibly everything. This episode turned into something of a therapy session for me because, Eric's an extremely bright guy. And I might be of middling intelligence, but I'm very curious and open and loving. And I think Eric recognized that and wanted to impart some wisdom on me. And I'm glad he did. We've since, I think, become friends in a sense. I really like him, and we're going to hopefully stay in touch, maybe work on projects together. Who knows? But I do want to tell you, he has a Substack coming hopefully soon. He's got a great podcast, Terrifying Questions, and right now the co-host is Tal Ruspoli, one of my other guests and friends. You should definitely check that out. Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It's really good. He brings up a terrifying question and they sort of debate it in a lovely way, and you will learn something, you will laugh. Great intersection of philosophy and comedy. So yeah, Eric has stuff going on. I will put links up in the show notes. You can reach out to me if you have any questions. That's mtp.dog/contact. And, dial into what Eric's up to. One little thing I will tell you, as far as Substack goes, I also have a Substack. It's called the Raised by Whoops Substack. I write fiction stories. I write true stories. I do some of what I call numbskull journalism. It's there for you. It's free. You can subscribe. I would really appreciate it if you did. If you want to pay, I could use the dough because all this stuff takes time and is, it's a non-zero expense to put out podcasts and buy microphones and all that type of stuff. So if you want to support it, I could use it. If not, I'll still do it anyway. Just know that it's there. What else? Hey, we're lucky to be here. We're lucky to be alive and well-fed and making it, I'm grateful. I'm grateful for my friends, for my strangers, for my health, for my wife, for my dog. I'm just very, very grateful to be a person in the world with loving friends and family. I hope you are too. And I hope you're doing fun and interesting things. If you know anyone that you'd like to hear on this show, please let me know. Again, that's mtp.dog/contact. And I'll see if I can try not to embarrass you in front of the friend that you've recommended to me. How about that? Deal. All right. Enjoy this episode with my new friend, Eric Kaplan. Until next time, adios.
I guess I'm on team non-judgmental, but with caveats.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to lead in. Mm-hmm. How do you feel?
Oh, are we recording already?
We are. Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
We just now started.
Oh.
Just this moment.
Okay.
But you talking about judgmental.
Yeah.
Where are your feelings on free will?
Oh, so free will, I think, is real. I think it's our fundamental experience of our lives that it's to some degree up to us. and it's impossible to tell the story of your life in a way that doesn't make reference to it being to some degree up to you.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, you've been, I always tend to think like all things being equal, if I were born in your time with your parents in the exact same settings, I would be you. Right. And vice versa.
Well, but did you have any choices along the way?
Oh yeah, for sure. A choice that's a funny thing, like defining the difference between choice and will. Like that choice is a product of will. Like your will is to make those types of choices. And is it predictable? I was thinking about it the other day in the context of the algorithm, you know, how it can predict and know. And you can really game the system with the human mind and know all kinds of things about the choices people will make, right? If a program can know the choices I'm going to make before I do, even, what am I, a program?
I don't think you're a program.
Yeah. You don't feel like a program.
Do you feel like a program?
Sometimes. I feel like, yeah, when I see something that I like that was delivered to me by a robot, you know, that knew I would like it based on, you know, whatever metadata it has on me. And I mean,
so you feel ashamed that the program knows you so well?
I feel it's like there's a dark implication there that, like, yeah, not ashamed, but it's like
humbled
and revealed in a way. You know what I mean? Like something was, my pants were pulled down and it's like, oh, you do have a mole shaped like, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Sometimes you could find yourself in like a flirty situation with someone and then you're like, oh, we're both cold. Let's end up in this sleeping bag tonight. Like, yeah, let's do it. And then you're like, at the time, you each could say, we're not trying to pursue an erotic relationship. But then the next morning you did. And then it's like, was that really a surprise? Yeah. Couldn't you kind of tell? And yet, so there's that aspect of us where we have, where we're part of nature. I want to say, I was going to use the word animalistic and I thought that sounded judgy. But I'll say we're part of nature.
Right.
But then, you know, there are also people who will starve themselves to death for a political reason.
Right.
So we're also not part of nature.
Yeah. Yeah. We can defy our nature.
Yeah.
In a way that's, it seems unique to the animal kingdom.
It is. Yeah. And we can live a life that's meaningful to us along dimensions that are not natural. Sure. Like we can say, let's think of a less sanctimonious example. You know, somebody can spend his life or her life playing bridge. And by the way, before people invented bridge, the algorithm could not say, I bet people are going to want to play bridge.
Sure.
You know, we're able to create possibilities for ourselves and for others, which that algorithm is never going to know because it's looking at past behavior. Now, but it's past behavior of what Charles Taylor calls self-interpreting animals. So we are animals that interpret ourselves. So you can say, I'm going to have a dinner party for a bunch of people and I'm trying to decide whether to serve food that's rich in sugar and fat or rusty nails. Well, the first,
yes.
You know, because we're humans and we're not rust monsters. We don't consume iron in that form.
Yeah. Given the choices.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm just, I feel like I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't already know. So.
Well, yeah. Welcome to the club, man. That's actually a great title for a podcast.
I'm not saying anything that everybody doesn't already know.
Yeah. Welcome to the, I'm not saying anything. I'm here with Eric Kaplan. Yeah, man, I'm not smart enough to argue what I feel like my position is on free will because I don't have any degree of certainty. I come from a place of like, I just don't know. I have intuitions.
Did the Jesuits get to you as a youngster?
No, I was not. I was raised Catholic.
That because I saw in your book that you were confirmed. So
no, I actually did. I didn't get confirmed. I was raised Catholic, but yeah, I was never confirmed. I said no. I passed on it because I didn't feel like I could make that commitment in an earnest way.
Right. But then that's almost on a deeper level, a pretty Christian approach that the things you do matter.
Considerably.
And it's not simply a question of getting along to the social expectation. Right. If they're like, come on, Andrew, just get confirmed. It'll make your grandma happy.
Right.
And you're like, no, it's more important to me. I don't want to do it if it's going to be a sham.
Yeah. That was, I didn't know quite why it was that important to me at that age. I just, something, you know, you follow your gut.
Yeah.
Who's in charge of that gut? Is the microbes in there? Is it, you know?
Microbes? I don't know that the microbes would care terribly much if you got confirmed.
Right.
Whoa, let's have some wine and bread, right?
Yeah, it sounds great. Yeah. Dump it in. A sanctimonious, sanctified snack. Yeah. The Christian thing, no, I didn't get. I mean, I got a lot of Christian indoctrination.
Yes. That's,
you know, but one thing I got through Catholic school, which I think the best way to create a skeptic is to teach them all religions.
Okay.
And we got a lot. I had 13 years of comparative religion. I mean, I don't know if it's just unusual or what, but I learned about Sikhs.
Yeah.
I learned about Muslims. I learned about, you know, all kinds of different faiths. And I came away with the impression that there's not a whole lot of difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're splitting hairs over things that, I don't know, there was an old joke where like a guy was about to jump off a bridge and the guy comes to him and is like, hey, what's going on? And they start talking about religion and they're, yeah, I'm in the same church. Oh yeah, I believe this. Oh yeah. And then with a tiny little difference, the guy says, heretic, and shoves him over the bridge, you know?
Right.
And I felt like that pretty well encapsulates what happens. And
I view religion as a sort of cousin of art and a cousin of psychotherapy.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I think there are all these ways of exploring the space of human possibility.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's true that all religions are the same. Like, I'm Jewish, so even within Judaism, there are people for whom what's important about that is a universal commitment to justice. And then there's people for whom it's about the preservation of the ethnic continuity of the Jewish people. And those are pretty different approaches to life. So that's even within a religion.
Right.
And then, so if you want to say some Quakers who are, you know, they have no theology to speak of and they get together and they speak their hearts and they try to be sincere people. They're religious. And someone who's a Shinto kamikaze pilot.
Right.
And he wants to die for the glory of the
emperor,
the mountains and streams and emperor of Japan. They're pretty different.
For sure.
You know,
I guess where I'm, well, I draw that thing is that the idea of faith, right? If you have a faith in a supernatural being who has stake in the outcome of your decisions, that is all, to me, like there's a sameness in that.
Yeah, but a lot of religious people are atheists. They don't believe in a supernatural being. Yeah, this is a question that I dealt with in college, 'cause I was writing a thesis comparing a German philosopher named Nietzsche and a group of Buddhist philosophers who were called the Madhyamakas. And I was making the argument that that religion is sort of any way you organize your approach to what's most important to you. So I was, and then one of the people examining me on my oral committee said, well, but isn't religion about supernatural beings? And in my heart, I was like, is it?
Yeah, not exclusively.
Because here's what I said. I said, until relatively recently, people didn't have that distinction between supernatural and natural. And it's hard to cash out for my money precisely what it means, you know? Because, like, supposing you say like take your case and you're like, I'm not going to be confirmed. So Andrew, why not, get confirmed? It'll make your family happy. We'll give you a party. And you say, there's some things in life that are more important to me than parties or making my family happy. So you believe in some dimension of life that's more important than like social recognition. Why, and I'm not saying I know the answer to this question, but why wouldn't we call that dimension supernatural?
Sure.
Because I would say, well, what's natural? What's a natural thing for a teenager to care about? Well, you know, parties and dating and making your family happy, ultimately getting a job. And you're like, well, I don't care about those things. I care about this other thing. Sounds supernatural to me. I don't know.
We do think of our minds as this thing outside of time and space, right? That's somehow not part of the causal nexus of all
people
things.
People do say that, yeah.
Yeah, and is it, you know, that's a good question. I think it's worth thinking about it. I don't know that we could precisely nail it down, but it feels like intuition in my dumb brain tells me that it's a biomechanical product of this thing. My homeostasis requires me considering all kinds of stuff. And, you know, like there are evolutionary imperatives to being altruistic and having a moral compass. And
what's the evolutionary imperative that impels you to say no to your confirmation?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know that I have an answer for it, but I would think it has something to do, you know, everything kind of relates in a weird way to a status, and being recognizable to myself and to others as someone who could be honest and counted on for an opinion that's at least informed from the heart, if not just a desire to please.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's
so
like,
you feel you're seeking a higher status as someone who doesn't care about status.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's that trick, right? So I don't quite know how to lay it all down, but I do feel like if you ask the right questions, you know, you may not find the right answer, but you'll understand yourself a little better in the process.
So here's my worry about that approach. I tend to think that a scientific explanation is one that could conceivably be disproved.
Yes.
So if someone says, like, dogs only are motivated by meat, and I'm bringing this up because we have a dog with us today, and you're like, well, I'm putting a dish of broccolini and a dish of sausage in front of my dog, and he's picking the broccolini, then that disproves that claim about dogs. And I worry that everything we do is biological and evolutionary fails a test of science because no one could conceivably come up with anything people could ever, ever do that you couldn't come up with some kind of story.
Yeah.
Because you're like, people are motivated by status. Well, what about Andrew? He did this thing against status. Ah, that's the status of no status. And Now I'm like, I can play this game with you. But I don't know that what we're doing is science. It feels more like dogmatism because there's nothing that could conceivably ever convince you otherwise.
Sure.
It's like too much of it's too all-encompassing to me. Like, you know, science is the kind of thing that's like, did you know the reason why people have cystic fibrosis is that there's a gene that if you have one of it, it protects against cholera? No kidding. That's really surprising. Let's see if that's true, you know, and there's pretty well understood methods of figuring out if it's true or not. So I don't think we're just biological evolutionary disease. I don't think we're just biological machines designed by evolution. And I cannot prove that, but I don't think anyone can prove we are either.
Sure.
Because it's such a broad statement. I mean, another kind of weird thing is, like, you kind of wish, if you were trying to figure this out, that we had access to many planets where creatures had evolved intelligence.
Yeah.
And then you could be like, to be intelligent, you need to have eyes. Like, really? Yeah. 1,000 different beings evolved. Not a single race without eyes has ever evolved intelligence. And you're like, well, that's surprising, but you got the data. But we have only one case.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to reach a conclusion, I think, man.
I don't want to present what I'm thinking as a final conclusion.
I understand.
Yeah, I definitely, I'm the kind of person who I'm nervous of certain people. Mm-hmm. Like people who are very certain and feel like they've cracked the code and right. Know.
Who are you relaxed around?
Who am I relaxed around?
Yeah.
Yeah, people who have good ideas and are curious and are willing to just ask good questions. I think that's one of the things I'd look forward to most is people with good questions.
Well, what are some good questions you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk to you about writing because that's kind of, if you don't mind, I mean, you've...
I don't mind.
We started on a very serious note, but you're quite funny.
You're like, free will versus determinism. Go!
Go!
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't often get a great writer or a philosopher in here, so I'm going to do a little of both. So thanks.
You talk about what you want. It's your band.
Well, hey, man, you're my guest. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Writing, man. Like, you're quite funny.
Thanks,
you know,
man.
Did people, when you were growing up, did you get that note from people like, oh, gosh, Eric's so funny? Or were you cracking jokes?
I was cracking jokes and I was getting validation for it.
Yeah.
I once did a summer for the Student Conservation Association in New Mexico.
Is that where you're from? Are you from New Mexico?
No, I'm from Brooklyn.
Okay.
They would always give this speech to the tourists because we were doing some work in Carlsbad Caverns about leaving the trail and touching the formations. You're not supposed to leave the trail. You're not supposed to touch the formations. So everybody was listening. And I was like, leave the trail, touch the formations, and you're dead meat. So that got a good laugh from my coworkers. But then at some point, I had my sleeping bag up like out there in the kind of outback, and I was trying to find my way back to camp, and I didn't realize there was this barbed wire fence. So I'm kind of wandering around out there, and people observed me kind of wandering foolishly. And then I heard someone say, so the thing about Eric is he can be very funny when he wants to be, and also sometimes he's very funny when he does not want to be. So that's some validation I received about being funny.
Funny, yeah. And did that compel you to write funny stuff? Did you, like, when you got the writing bug, was it to be funny or was it to explain things?
Well, I started writing very short science fiction and horror and fantasy stories, and I was not trying to be funny. Hmm. Although I could be funny, like when we had to do committee reports on the 50 states, and when I had them to do, I would try and make them funny just because it seemed funny, you know. But I tended to kind of look down on that, and I didn't think that was a serious form of writing. I thought a serious form of writing would be like have somebody die or something like that. And I did a parody with my friend Desmond Devlin. We did a parody of the literary magazine, and I enjoyed that a lot. But I looked down on in that aspect of my writing because I didn't think it was serious. And and then a friend of mine, also named Andrew, said, you know, you shouldn't look down on it. You should take it seriously. It's a good thing to be able to do. And I was like, okay.
That's all it took.
It wasn't all it took. No, for a long time. And maybe even now I do sort of feel like, well, almost like it's too easy to be funny. And it kind of comes without any effort.
While if I'm like, I'm going to write a serious story about a woman who loses her child in the Civil War, like that sounds like eating my spinach. Mm-hmm. But if I'm just going to write a parody, that sounds fun and like it won't take, it won't be terribly hard. And I, as I'm saying this, it sounds like a really silly thing to believe. So maybe I'll stop believing it.
Well, that's quite funny. I think like writing for any sake,
yeah,
is an incredible thing. It's a wonderful device that we have as beings, that we've agreed upon these shapes and figures.
Oh, yes.
To communicate ideas.
Yeah.
That can be then translated to figures and shapes that make sense to another culture.
Yeah.
And then translated into film and television writing, to me, is like, it's a mystery. I have no context for it. I've never, you know, I sometimes feel like I might try to write cinematically, but I don't know, you know, I don't know how to be a journalist. I don't know really even how to be a writer, to be honest, other than just to sit down and think. And, but there's something about television writing specifically that seems like, to me, from my, like there's a mentorship and there's like an apprenticeship that you go through and a style of learning that doesn't, maybe it's analogous as like electricians and plumbers and tradespeople do that.
Yeah.
Did you have to?
I did. So, I mean, I guess one thing about television writing is you have to do it fast.
Yeah, you're on a pretty tight
You have to deadline. Do it fast. And that means in practice, most people do some version of what you're talking about of coming up through the ranks. Because if you're like, I mean, here's how it works, is that somebody will say, let's do a show about a tiger that it eats a magic pill and it's transformed into a dude and it marries this woman and they're living together and it's, she doesn't know he's a tiger. It's like, and then you pitch this to some form of capitalist and they're like, okay, I'm going to risk my shareholders' money and give you some money to do this show about the tiger. And if it's bad and no one likes it, you're going to get in a fair amount of trouble. I mean, not real trouble, like you won't be beaten with sticks, but people will be very unlikely to do your lion show if the tiger show lazy gigantic egg. So that means, oh, they've promised you X amount of money to do 13 episodes of this tiger show, one a week for 6 months. So this is a long-winded way of saying you better have some people who are going to be able to write it quickly and well.
Yeah.
And by well, we don't mean anything more than enough people will watch it that the people who gave you the money to do it will not feel like fools and want to come after you.
Right.
So you will need some people who you're pretty confident can do that. But the path to being somebody that people will trust to do that, it varies. I mean, so there's a really good writer named Ian Maxtone Graham, and he was hired by The Simpsons in the very beginning, and he's been there since then. And he proved his ability by writing a single sentence. And the people who were staffing it read this sentence and thought it was so funny that they hired him, and that's his story.
It's a damn good sentence. Do you
know what it was?
I would love that, yeah.
Yeah. The woman who marries me better be ready for some fucking.
That got on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's a good joke, right? Because joke. Obviously. Not she better be. I mean, she whiz.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I like any joke that can be interpreted so many.
Yeah, you know, that layers. Joke can be interpreted, I think, in at least three ways.
Yeah, that's like the guy's funny. Extremely dumb.
He seems pretty dumb. He seems to be bragging.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you get a whole sense of a very particular kind of guy who would say this. Yeah. And it's at the same time obviously true, but he doesn't realize that it's obviously true.
Yeah.
So it's a great joke. Good yeah. for Ian Max Joan Gray.
Yeah, well done. What was your entry? How did you get the gig?
Well, I had written for the Harvard Lampoon in college. And I also wrote for a magazine called Spy Magazine in college. So I had some degree of writing credits, but I wandered into philosophy grad school for a number of years. And then I decided with some consultation that I didn't want to be a philosophy professor. So I'm like, oh, I need to figure out something to do. Yikes. And a friend of mine who was writing for The Simpsons said, you could be a comedy writer if you put your mind to it. So I put my dissertation on ice for a year. It ultimately turned out to be on ice for about 25 years, and then I ultimately completed it. But
congrats.
Thank you.
Nice.
I put my dissertation on ice, and I wrote writing samples, and I sent them out, and ultimately I got a couple of offers, and the one I was able to take was for a Late Show with David Letterman. So that's, you know, a combination of knowing some people and also working hard to make sure that I would have something that would convey the notion that I could do this.
Were you a top 10 guy?
Yeah, I wrote top 10s.
That Ain't Eggnog?
I didn't write that one.
That was really funny. The top 10 Times Square, back when Times Square was dirty.
Sure, yeah. My favorite top 10 that I ever wrote was top 10 things to do if you're the tallest man in the world. And I said, get together with the shortest man in the world, go to a bar and beat up medium guys. The medium guys. How could your enemy be medium guys? It's like it's such a non, yeah. It's a non-specific yeah. adjective to apply to a human. Like I'm going through life in a rage against medium guys, you know. Although I've seen actually a meme where people claim to be angry at people of medium intelligence, that they claim that they themselves are smart, but they have something in common with dumb guys against the dreaded midwit, who's a medium person.
Yeah.
I consider this ridiculous. That you could be angry against the medium.
Yeah.
I guess most general reasons to be angry against a class of people are dumb.
Yeah. I think that immediately kicks you out of the top.
I suppose if you're like, I'm angry against those who are unkind or unjust or, you know, bigoted, fine. That sounds reasonable. But to be angry against those of middling intelligence, I find silly.
Yeah.
I also find it silly. I heard this once and I thought it was funny. It was a network executive complaining that people were stupid. I'm like, buddy, if people were smart, you wouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
you should get down on your knees in front of Lord Buddha and thank that people are stupid or behave in a way that you consider stupid.
Or behave in a way that you can predict.
Yes.
And sell them stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting. Do you think you can predict the behavior of those who are closest to you?
I don't know that I have the tools.
Mm.
I mean, to some degree, you know what someone might like, you know.
Right.
That type of prediction, yeah. But, you know, I'm not as close enough student of other people's behavior.
Right.
In that way, I just don't. I would imagine if I paid closer attention and cataloged things better and had a better memory, maybe, you know. I don't have the retention power that necessary.
Right. But how does it make you feel about yourself when you try to predict people's behavior?
That's a good question. How does it make me feel? You know, I worked in restaurants
mm-hmm.
a good portion of my life. I was a bartender, you know, doing mm-hmm. bars and restaurants and music clubs. And you want to be able to, it's kind of crucial to be able to anticipate, you know, the size of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of music is it? How much do those guys drink? What
right.
does it, you know, that type of. And then just like customer behavior, you know, there's always some aberrant dickhead who throws a wrench in the thing, wants the busboy to bring him wine.
Right.
You know, so trying to predict people can be so futile.
Right.
And it's like, you know, like tossing something up in the air and it perfectly landing in a place that you didn't mean to hit, but it feels really satisfying. Like you scored a basket on accident.
Yeah.
So when you are occasionally right, you're like, I knew it.
Right.
You know, but did you know it? I feel like it's like a trick.
I guess what I was wondering is like, if you were to live your life as if you were the bartender and everyone that you loved and cared about was your customer, would that feel emotionally satisfying?
No, I like surprise, man.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know that. I mean, there's, you know, for sure you want to predict some things because I am ultimately a pleaser.
You know? Oh, you are?
Like, yeah, for sure.
How did that happen?
Well, it's funny, like being funny to me has always been really important to be able to make people laugh. Because I feel, I mean, not to beat a dead horse, the more on at the end of this book, I do feel like I'm of middling intelligence. I grew up around very smart people. Like my father was an attorney. Mm-hmm. Everybody else in my family was kind of an achiever academically to some extent.
And right.
I just wasn't.
That's so
just
you have this script that everybody can be ranked along one metric called intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's a unique metric and you're in the middle.
I could, yeah, yeah. And I could just
But make, you know that's crazy, right?
I'm sure it is.
But I'm just saying, like, if you needed to rank animals from best to worst, like, and I was like, which is better, a swan or a squirrel?
Mm-hmm.
Would that question make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, to someone maybe, but,
well, but I'm fishing for the answer. No.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
That is like, I mean, at climbing trees, the squirrel is your best bet.
Yeah.
At gliding down a pond and making it look pretty, I would go with the swan
every time,
10 times out of 10. So if it's true that we cannot rank animals and say definitively that whatever the goose is in the middle, I feel that, Andrew, you shouldn't rank people and say that you are in the middle.
Yeah.
Because you're a unique being with all sorts of qualities and like the idea that there's just a unique order with like, you know, Jesus at the top and Stalin at the bottom or whatever, I think is wrong.
Yeah, Stalin. Well, it was more of a, just like, how do I fit into a thing, right? In a social context, I can either make someone laugh.
Yes.
By doing something or saying something funny.
Yes.
Or I can make them happy by providing some sort of literally heavy lifting. My mom would always say, Andrew, you're tall. Can you get this?
Right.
You know, and she showed me very young. She was like, can you do this? You know, like, do you know where the laundry goes in? You know, and it would show me tasks and then be like, okay, now you're capable of doing
the laundry. Have you ever met a person who you're just happy that they are who they are and you don't need them to do anything to you or for you?
Well, yeah. I mean,
like a child, for
example. Yeah, like children, for sure. Yeah.
So can you love yourself and appreciate yourself in the same way that like Andrew is a cool guy? He doesn't need to please anyone. He doesn't need to do anything. Just to be Andrew is itself enough.
Well, at this point in my life, pleasing people is my joy. It's my language. You know, it's like, to be useful is the thing I like the most. It gives me pleasure to know that I've helped someone. It's a small thing in a way, but it to me is like, I mean, eventually you and everyone you know will be dead forever.
Yeah.
And
some of them will die horribly.
Yeah.
Perhaps torn apart by hyenas.
It's non-zero chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like it when people hustle to please you?
Depending.
Sometimes you don't.
Yeah, sure. If it's uncomfortable and it feels like they're hurting themselves at my expense, I would never ever want that.
But I guess what I'm wondering is like, it's like that joke about the masochist says, beat me, and the sadist says no. Maybe the best way to please people is not to please people. Maybe the people in your life would love it if Andrew is just Andrew and is not trying to please them or anticipate their needs.
But at what point is Andrew disassociated from that thing? Because that's like, the thing that makes me me is that, or part of it anyway, is that I like doing that.
It's not the only thing that makes you you.
It's, no, for
it's
sure.
It's a story it's, you tell about yourself.
Right, right. But like, take for instance, this morning, like making breakfast.
Right.
I love that sort of thing.
I believe it. I'm not saying go forth and
fuck them.
Fuck everybody and be painful.
Right.
I'm not seeing that. Yeah. I guess I'm saying that if you can love yourself for who you are, that's a gift to people just to be around you.
Mm.
Like a flower or a child or an animal or a sunset, you know, and like, if you're like, the sun was pissed off because it really wanted to do a good sunset and you didn't come out, you'd be like, oh my God, the sun is being so needy these days. And it kind of feels good that the sun doesn't give a shit about it.
Mm.
It's just doing it. And we love the sun for that. Like the sun, I don't want to say the sun is an asshole, but the sun does show a certain amount of lack of concern.
You ever had faced, I hate, if you don't want to answer this, it's perfectly fine, but have you ever faced depression? Or,
yeah, I have.
On like a semi-predictable basis or just at times?
Well, I don't face depression anymore. Because I came to realize through dint of, you know, many years of working on myself, and I took group therapy, I did a lot of things, that self-attacking voice wasn't me. And it was not to be trusted either.
Hmm.
It was something that for various reasons in the dynamic of my life, I had come to think that the way to be safe was to attack myself and to view myself as wanting. And that this script, I guess you'd call it, I had internalized it really deeply, but it was still false.
Hmm. So you were able to reason yourself out of
it. Wasn't depression. Reasoning. It was by what I would call corrective emotional experiences.
Interesting.
It wasn't reason, but it was a process of self-transformation that included some things that I will say I learned are true, but simply learning the fact wasn't enough.
Right.
Part of it had to be practicing. It's funny to, I won't say this, it seems a little dramatic, but it'd be funny to say the alternative to depression is terror. I don't think that's true, but I do think there was a sense in which I had to jump off the diving board because it's like that I'm not good enough, I need to work harder, I'm not good enough seemed like it was a path to safety.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it wasn't, right. But it seemed like it was.
Right.
So then to be able to let go of that way of looking at the world is a little bit of an oh shit moment. I think one of the things that I think I also indulged in was a workaholism, which was using work as a way of dealing with emotional pain. And the way I thought about it was like, if I'm going to spend today working, it was an acceptable day and I'm an acceptable person.
Yeah.
And if I spend the day not working, it wasn't an acceptable day and I'm not an acceptable person. And it's hard to put that down, but I can think you see what the problem with that approach is, right? What?
Well, it's not possible to always only work, and you will at some point not, and you will invariably feel like a piece of shit.
That's true. I was going to say just more from a just kind of logic standpoint. If you spend a day working, doing something bad or trivial, then it's not a good day.
Sure.
And if you spend the day doing something meaningful and lovely, like you know, talking to your aunt. Right. It is a good thing. Sure. So it's not a correct method of telling whether a day was well spent or not. Mm-hmm. But your other point is absolutely true. You will feel like shit and also not be fun to be around.
Yeah, you'll resent your work.
You'll resent your work. Yeah. And then you might resent the people in your life you're working for.
100%.
And basically, you'll be a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I guess I was addressing that because you said, well, is it enough to just realize that? No, because you need to practice. Because if I'm like waking up in the middle of the night and be like, oh no, I need to come up with a script idea. So it's like a alcoholic reaching for a bottle. It's like me reaching for a work project. It's a little frightening to be like, you know, don't do that. It'd be tempting to grab a notebook and write down a list of script ideas or send an email to someone. We need to meet and talk about this script idea. And just be like, no, I guess I feel frightened. I'm feeling frightened right now. And then I do think this internal family systems approach is pretty good, which is sort of like to somehow reach to the frightened child within me who felt the feeling at the age of 6 or 7. And I think we're pretty similar here. High achieving families, that felt like if you don't do something worthwhile, you're in danger. You're a bad kid. You're going to lose the love of the people you need to survive. And I try and address that child myself. But it's a question of practicing certain emotional things, facing certain emotions and coping with them in ways other than the workaholism or the depression,
right,
or the self-attack.
Well, the reason I brought that up, like the first time I ever heard the idea of loving yourself.
Yes.
I was an adult living in California.
Uh-huh.
And like I thought about it. It's like, God, do I love myself? And the closest that I could come to like a moment where I was like really thought about I'm okay.
Yeah.
Is like anytime I'm eating popcorn and I manage to do one at a time instead of all of it at once.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, good on you, man. You're going to be all
right. Right. So that's not loving yourself.
No,
because that's
not
loving
even close.
Your behavior.
Yeah. It's not even that. The point was that I had no frame of reference for self-love.
Right.
And this, my self-deprecation and that self-attack.
Yes.
I know that quite well. And it's a practice. I appreciate what you're saying about it because you cannot reason yourself out of depression. Mm-hmm. I definitely face depression in these very unpredictable moments that have nothing to do with the world around.
Right.
It's just, it's like, it feels biochemical.
Yeah.
I can feel it coming and it just sucks. But I know how, to me, you know, we are a story. We tell these stories about ourselves, and I'd like to expurgate that thing, you know? So I just pull up the monster. I look right at it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the moron. That's this idea of the just fool, and to face it and make it not hurt, you know, and not, make it not a whip to get myself into some kind of shape and just be like, okay, that's a story about myself. I can contextualize this, make it a little funny, and then move on.
Can I offer a reframing, Andrew?
Please, anytime.
So you're saying there's a part of yourself that castigates yourself and hurts you.
Of course.
Yeah. And you want to kill and expunge and obliterate that part of you.
No, I want to put it in the surface so I see it happening.
You want to see it, but you also use the word expunge.
Yeah, that's maybe my poor wording. I want to get it out. Like if you're literally sponging something up and you've gotten it out and you can see what it is, like, oh man, that's Coca-Cola.
And then what are you going to do with it once you see it?
It's that, to me, it's similar to what you're saying. It's a practice, like meditation.
But what are you going to do with it once you see it?
If I can turn it into a joke, great. If I can turn it into art.
What you're taking a part of yourself and your story you're telling now is about utilizing it and transforming it into something you can use.
Mm-hmm. Something positive.
But in a sense, that's a very harsh attitude. Like if you said, what are we going to do with Bob? Well, we're going to take him out and we're going to look at him and then we're going to transform him into someone we can use. Seems like Nazi-ish almost, you know?
Sure, sure.
And the reframe that I would say is like, see this part of yourself as a part of yourself and love it and accept it.
I think I may be just framing it incorrectly, but it's to recognize the thing, get it out in the open, look at it, see what it is for what it is, right? That it is a narrative, it's a story. Yes, I do. For certain, I use it, right?
But right.
I also I recognize it, and part of what I'll do with it is I try to help other people see it in themselves.
Right. But at any point in this story, is there a compassion for your own pain?
To the extent that it makes me better at loving others.
So no, because if you say, if someone comes up to you and says, I'm feeling an awful lot of emotional pain, and you're like, well, if that makes you better at loving others, okay. If not, shut up.
Right. Yeah.
That's a somewhat cruel thing to say.
I would definitely, the things that for instance, building this van.
Yeah.
The things that I said to myself at times of mistake or, when I would do something wrong, I would never talk to an employee, a coworker, a friend, even an enemy. I'm not that much of a dick, but I will say things to myself that I would never say to anyone. And I recognize what that is.
Right. And what is it?
What's cruel. It's cruelty. Shitty behavior. It's me
being cruel to yourself.
Yeah, it's me being awful to one of the creatures on the planet.
Yeah.
Which is a thing I don't want to do.
Right. And then there's this interesting kind of mindfuck thing, which is like, even your desire to be cruel to yourself, don't be cruel to that either.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get it. I'm really thankful for your impromptu therapy lessons. Is this you paying me back for the breakfast?
I hope we can be friends. I hope you come visit if you ever make it to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I do from time to time.
Okay, yeah, let's hang out.
Yeah, no, I'm very grateful for this. We didn't even get to talk about your amazing blues collection.
We didn't talk about my blues collection. We didn't
talk about,
the time I saved the last albino yak from a flaming furnace at great personal risk. Because it didn't happen. I mean, it's still, we didn't talk about it.
We still didn't. We missed it. What an opportunity missed. I do want to continue our conversation, and it doesn't have to be recorded. I just quite
Let's keep talking. And, we could do a sequel. I'm around for a few days.
Great. Yeah, yeah. Well,
any last licks?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that very thing. You are a man of considerable intellect and wit. Is there someone in the world that you would like to send a message to, living, deceased, future?
Oh. Yeah, there are two writers. One of them is named Olga Tokarczuk, and she wrote a book called Flights. And the other one is Otessa Moshfegh, and she wrote a book called Homesick for Another World. And I'm very grateful to both of them. Both of these books really made me feel more like I understood my life better, and that I was a better person for having experienced them, not in like a vain way, but just sort of like I was able to kind of open up my heart to life and to other people because of the work of these two writers. So I would say thank you to Ms. Tokarczuk and Ms. Moshfegh.
It's a great title.
Great writer. That's Homesick what I'm
for
saying.
Another world. Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. I'll be seeing you around.
Yeah, see you around, Andrew. Thank you.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so much good. But you're the key to my peace of mind.
soul was in the law.